Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's program, we are talking about franchising with Richie Taylor of Manning Fulton's Corporate and Franchise Law Practice Group, where he leads the firm's franchise practice. Richie serves as general counsel to dozens of emerging and established franchise systems. And in that role, he helps direct each client's legal strategy to accomplish the client's short and long-term business objectives. Additionally, Richie routinely represents franchisees in evaluating the actual franchise opportunities and growing their businesses. Richie is a recognized leader in the franchise community. He was one of the first lawyers in private practice nationwide to be awarded the Certified Franchise Executive designation by the Institute of Certified Franchise Executives. Richie serves on the Board of Governors of the Institute of Certified Franchise Executives, which is the governing body for the CFE certification program, and develops training programs for franchise executives. He is the founding chair of the North Carolina Bar Association's Committee on Franchising. His franchise law expertise has been recognized by his inclusion in the Best Lawyers in America for Franchise Law. Richie's clients appreciate his results-oriented approach to the practice of law, where he helps each client navigate the legal requirements to achieve their objectives. The website for the firm is manningfulton.com. That's manningfulton.com. And you can also find them at Twitter's manningfultonnc. So Richie, get us started. Tell us the true definition of what a franchise is legally and what we need to be thinking about when we're considering either becoming a franchisee or a franchisor.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for inviting me to be on your program today. A franchise is any business relationship that meets three tests, where a franchise, the relationship is going to have, is granting someone the right to use the trademark, to be able to operate under the same trademark as the franchisor, that their products are substantially associated with that trademark. That would be the first part. The second part is that their franchisor is going to provide substantial training, assistance, or support to the franchisee. And the third is that is there more than $500 that's going to change hands within the first 6 months of operation? And any business relationship that meets those tests and is a written agreement is going to be a franchise, whether or not the parties call it that.
So what's the difference between a franchise and a license?
Okay, that's a great question. So all franchise agreements are going to be license agreements, right, because they're going to involve the licensing of intellectual property, including the trademark. But that doesn't mean all license agreements are franchise agreements. So franchise agreements are a subset of the licensing relationship.
So I could be out there and I could be in business, but I don't want to give them the business in the box. I don't want to train people. I don't want to do that. I license the use of my IP, my trademarks. But that doesn't mean I have an obligation to help them succeed in the operational aspects, right?
Correct. If nothing more than just a trademark license, then that's not going to constitute a franchise. But if you're doing more than that, if you're wanting to have more control than is necessary to have your license, then you could be a franchise.
Okay, so when we're out there, we deal with franchises daily basis, McDonald's franchises, other restaurants, nursing care facilities. There's all kinds of things that are out there. So how do we as a franchisee or potential franchisee look at the benefits of being a franchisee, the downside, and how do we pick where we go and what we need to know?
Okay. Well, a franchise, you need to recognize that franchising is being in business for yourself but not by yourself, right? So there's a partnership in place between you and the franchisor, which is both good and may not be good depending on who you are as a franchisee and what your goals are, right?
Right.
Because you're going to have to follow their rules and their standards. And that's what provides a benefit. If you're going to McDonald's, for example, you may or may not like their hamburgers, but you know that what they're going to taste like, you know what the French fries are going to taste like, you know how the restaurant is going to be generally laid out, and you know about how much it's going to cost you to eat there. Whether you're eating in there in Carrboro or in China, it's going to be about the same experience. But that uniformity might not be for you. If you really want to, at the end of the day, you really want to have your own business and you want to do things your own way, then you probably shouldn't be buying a franchise because you've got to be willing to follow the systems.
So let's talk about those systems. So as a franchisee, let's say I've bought, and I like to pick on McDonald's because it's been one of the most successful franchises out there. So if we're thinking of going in and buying a McDonald's franchise or any franchise, what can we expect to be getting with that purchase?
Well, great. You're going to, at a minimum, you're going to get the right to use their trademarks. Almost all franchisors are going to be providing some kind of pre-opening training. You would be looking for that as far as the training and whether it's going to be adequate to help you get up and going. The value of having a national brand for some kind of franchise systems, the value of the brand may not have been established. Clearly, McDonald's is a very well-established brand. And depending on the industry, the branding may be more or less important, right? In the hotel industry, for example, branding is very important. You don't see very many independent hotels nowadays. Everyone is affiliated with some kind of flag and some kind of captive client base who are value that brand and frequent that brand. So those are some of the things that you would be looking for.
So when I buy, I get an operating manual. I get some training. I get told how to do business according to those standards and stuff. But do they also help me find the location? Do they help me put the equipment in, get it built, all of those kind of things too?
Right. So the location depends on the system. They may or may not have an active real estate program where they've predetermined sites to go into, but clearly the franchisor is going to want to approve that site, and you're going to get the benefit of the experience they've had in developing sites because they know the demographics that work best for their sites and the traffic count and those kind of things that are important to you and making sure you get those a site that, based on historical performance, has worked well for that franchise system. The equipment, they're going to have a standard list of equipment that they're going to want to see in their kitchen or in their operation. And hopefully they've also got relationships with those equipment vendors that may reduce the cost to you of acquiring that equipment or reducing your cost of inventory because of the ability to pool the resources and negotiate better contracts for purchases.
So we come in, and again, I'm going to use McDonald's to lead because I think everybody in the world has probably been in a McDonald's at some time. You walk in, you know you're going to see the Golden Arches, Ronald's there, used to have all the Hamburglar, all those kind of things, you know, Happy Meals and all of that language. But when we're behind the scenes, what do we expect? How interactive is it? How much of an ongoing cost can we expect? Because I'm sure as successful as we are, there's a piece of the pie that goes back to the franchisor. And how do those relationships get determined and how do they get negotiated? And just from the really established, like a McDonald's, to one, like you were saying, that's not that recognizable and you're in the early stage of getting possibly one of the first franchises.
Right. The level of support is going to vary widely on the franchise system itself. But as you note, I mean, these things aren't free. There's going to be royalties that would be paid to the franchisor in exchange for the right to use the trademark and the systems and whatever support is being provided. Typically, there's an upfront initial franchise fee that covers a lot of these pre-opening costs, and then there's ongoing royalties that are a percentage of gross income, and that would vary depending on the system and the industry that are involved. We perhaps on service-based franchises, we might see a higher royalty than more on product-based franchises. And then there may be advertising funds that would be cooperative funds that are additional fees paid into the franchisor to develop all those great commercials that you see on television that the brand has developed, that they're able to pool their money together to spread the cost around of both developing those commercials and, if in the case of larger systems, being able to actually run those ads on the air.
So what I'm hearing is when I buy a franchise, I'm doing my homework. I want to get one that has their ducks in the row, that they know how to be in business, that they have experience with multiple locations. And I need to know what all is included in that initial franchise and then the ongoing cost and what do I get in return for that cost.
That's right. And the way that you find that out is that franchising is a regulated industry. The Federal Trade Commission regulates the sale of franchises, and you receive, as part of the pre-sale process, each franchisee should receive a franchise disclosure document, or FDD, where the government has laid out and said that these are the information that every franchisee needs to know at a minimum before they buy a franchise. And it lays out the fees. It lays out what level of support the franchisor is going to provide. It lets you know who these people are, what their professional history is, their litigation history, their bankruptcy history, what are the relationship with suppliers, are there any rebates that the franchisor is receiving from those suppliers, who owns the trademarks, and what kind of territory am I going to get, and when can this thing be terminated, and how long does this agreement last? And all of those things are in the FDD, or franchise disclosure document.
So you just said something that was interesting. I remember a few years ago talking to a franchisee who had been the only franchise in the area, and it was basically, I think they divided the area by zip codes for the franchise. And suddenly, across the street, the zip code is different, and he has a new franchise that comes in that's just within a small, short distance from where he is, and he's been operating successfully. How much protection or how much restriction is in there for we get a location, we're going to have a territory, and then how do we check out whether that's a good territory, a good agreement for when other franchises are going to come in, those kind of things?
Well, the franchise disclosure document will have to tell you how that's calculated. Now, whether it's adequate or not is a different question. And the best way to find that out is both to do your own internal math as you're thinking through how am I going to make a profit in this, and am I going to have enough customers that are captive to my business to be able to do this. The zip code may or may not matter as much. If you're just service-based business where you're mailing out to money mailer, then dividing by zip codes may be the right thing to do. If you're a restaurant and you've got another one across the street, that may not be the optimal way to have set up the territories. The best way to find out is in the back of the FDD is a list of the names and addresses and phone numbers of all of the franchisees, and to call them and ask them, how far away does your typical customer come from? About how many different customers do you have a year, and see what kind of metrics they have so that you can start to feel if that's adequate. Because as you noted, at the end of the day, the only protection you have is whatever's in the agreement. You have to assume that the franchisor, while they may promise you otherwise, has the right and therefore may open up within the right beside wherever the boundaries are.
Right. So when we're doing this due diligence, I know it's becoming very attractive for people to buy franchises and things like that, but how do we understand doing that due diligence process? They're giving us the FDD. We need to do our homework also on geography, where things are located, population densities. How do we and what should we be doing as a potential franchisee to do that due diligence beyond what they hand us?
A lot of franchisors are going to give you, as part of that development process, they're going to give you perhaps the demographic information. They may have software and those kind of things that give you the census information so you can look at a map and say, this is where we're thinking about as far as where that territory is going to be set. I mean, one of the other things you want to do is work with a lawyer who is an experienced franchise lawyer who's seeing a lot of different, an array of a lot of franchise agreements, a lot of FDDs over the course of a year. And so you're able to get that cross-pollinization that you wouldn't otherwise get.
So what kind of things right now are we seeing in the course of the way the economy is? Are franchises more popular now? Are they making a bigger role in North Carolina's economy and around the country? What's that dynamic, and how does that play into us making a decision?
Well, franchising has a very important role in North Carolina economy as well as the economy of our country. One out of 11 jobs in North Carolina is a job related to the franchise industry.
Wow, okay.
So it's an $18 billion industry in North Carolina. It's bigger than the tech sector in North Carolina, and we don't think of that in that way. But many of the businesses that you frequent every day are franchise businesses. We are seeing a growth in franchising. Many folks who have been displaced in the workplace have decided that they would like to build equity for themselves as opposed to working for someone else. And so the average age of a franchisee is 49 years old. So it's somebody who's had a prior career, and this is a a new start for them.
So we get into the franchise. We get a great attorney like yourself that's able to help us evaluate that franchise agreement. How much of a franchise agreement is negotiable in that course of it, or is it just here it is, if you want this franchise, you take it as is?
Well, it's really going to be driven by the marketplace, and in part that's going to be the size of the franchisor. I mean, at some point over time, a franchisor is going to want to have more consistency in their franchise agreement. Mm-hmm. So clearly a McDonald's, their offer is what it is, and if you would like to sign up with McDonald's, you would need to sign what they are offering.
Right.
That being said, and on the other end of the spectrum, an emerging franchisor, clearly there's going to be more opportunity to negotiate. That being said, I have seen fairly large franchisors recently where I didn't think they would negotiate were willing to negotiate because they've got a qualified franchise prospect who's got the ability to open up and do well. Do they really want to lose them to another brand who would love to have them as their franchisee if there's something that's truly unreasonable in the franchise agreement that needs to be changed?
Now, I'm not going to name names on some franchises, but we're seeing them out there. I go in and, you know, go grab a sandwich somewhere, and what I start to see is that where franchisees do not adhere to their agreement. So you walk into, let's say, a Subplace, and they're supposed to have certain decor, and they're supposed to have certain foods, and you see them serving hamburgers and pizzas, which are not part of the franchise agreement. What are the ramifications of you accepting these terms and conditions and then not adhering to them?
Well, you need to make sure that you're following the standards. The risk of failing to do so would be that the franchisor could terminate the franchise agreement, which would leave you of your ability to use their trademark and their proprietary products. Most franchise agreements are going to have a non-compete that would restrict your ability to operate a competing business in that location or a location near any of their other locations, which, you know, could put you in default under your lease because you wouldn't have the wherewithal to be able to generate income. So you need to go in on the front end deciding that you believe in the system and you're going to follow the system. And if you decide that you don't want to follow the system, then I would recommend that you sell your business to someone else as opposed to doing things that would violate this agreement.
So I have a client that has a franchise, and I'm not going to say what kind of franchise. And what we're finding is with that business is that the franchisor is really unreasonable into how they're doing things. Wanted to sell the franchise, wouldn't agree for it to be sold, wouldn't agree to change different things, location, all those kind of things. So what are our options whenever we're getting to a point, we know we've agreed to something, and let's say you're one of the early franchisees in, and you find the flaws in the design after you've gotten the franchise. What can you do going back to the franchisor about things that aren't working, about services that are not being provided, about whether it's advertising packages or just the whole mechanism of how things they were supposed to provide support in return for that lovely fee going back?
Well, and they have an obligation, both sides of the agreement have an obligation of a covenant of good faith and fair dealing in any contract to deal with each other in good faith and operate with fair dealing with each other. And if they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, then they may be in breach of that. If they made representations before opening the franchise, they may have committed fraud in the process of doing that, which would open them up to potential escalated damages and perhaps rescission of the agreement.
So when we're having those kind of conflicts, what court are we in? Where are we filing suit? Is it a state court? Is it a federal court? What kind of?
It would depend on the dispute resolution provision in the franchise agreement. The many franchise agreements call for arbitration or perhaps even for mediation beforehand. In that situation, of course, it wouldn't be in a court. It may or may not be in your state, depending on what the franchise agreement provides. Many of the franchisors obviously would like to have the dispute resolution in their home jurisdiction. So the agreement as a default may provide for that. If they're out-of-state franchisor, then in court, it would probably be in federal court because they're in two different states.
Okay. So we have all these things percolating in our mind. We've left our job, whether laid off or whatever. We've decided to take some of our retirement and our investment funds. we're buying a franchise, we're doing our due diligence. What factors come into play on how successful we're going to be? If we're going whole hog, we're supporting this, we've got the agreements nailed. What makes the difference between a successful franchisee and an unsuccessful franchisee?
I think the most important thing is to get your feel of, do you believe in this system or product on the front end, and then executing against that system and being diligent about it. If in knowing if this is the right thing for you on the front end, as far as how imagining your lifestyle living in that franchise. So if you are somebody who likes to sleep in the morning, then a bagel franchise is probably not right for you.
Right.
If you don't like to talk to people and sell things, then you probably shouldn't be in a retail franchise. Okay. Because that's what you're going to want to do. You want everybody to know that you own this business, and you hope they'll come by and buy their shoes at your store.
Now, I've seen people buy franchises, and it's been reputable franchises, well established, and they've still bombed. So how and what do we do as a franchisor and the franchisee? If we've got the right, you know, we're not getting up when we like to sleep in and those kind of things, how do we make sure that we're engaged in what kind of systems or people, what is it that we can do to make our success more likely?
I think part of it, one of the questions I would ask the franchisor beforehand is how they have dealt with those kind of situations when they've had people who are on the either failing or on the bubble of failing. I mean, did they reacquire the franchise? You can see that in the franchise disclosure document. It will tell you if they've reacquired the franchise, or did they terminate them, or
did they
help
come
transition?
In and learn, right.
Did they have some kind of, you know, SWAT team or otherwise that comes in to help people turn things around? And are they committed to not leaving people on the field, if you will? And you get that feel on the front end and talking with the franchisees as well before you buy the franchise to see if the franchisor has that level of commitment, I think would be one of the things that I would do.
So this is business, and I call it a business in a box when you get a franchise. You get operating, you get your intellectual property and that kind of stuff. But there are still elements that we have to deal with: hiring, recruiting managers, sourcing food, all kinds of things we have to do there. Is there a better way to do that, or are there some, as a franchise, what is it we need to know staffing-wise, planning-wise, that either comes in that agreement and is operating, or is that stuff that we can still put our personality on?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, staffing is a good example where the franchisor is not hiring your employees. I mean, you're hiring your employees. We're seeing with McDonald's in the news as of late, and some other chains, where people have been not understanding that fact, that franchisors aren't involved in the hiring of their in how much employees
right.
are being paid and those kind of decisions.
And if there's benefits or anything like
that's
that,
right.
McDonald's, whoever, does not dictate that.
Each franchisee has the ability and right to do that, and they're the ones setting their own internal employment policies. So that being said, I would look to other successful franchisees in the system and ask them on these kind of things where there is discretion, what are they finding that's successful? Try them out, keep the ones you don't like, and then don't keep the things that don't work.
Right. So if we've never been a business owner and we come into a franchise, the benefit is we have a lot of this already defined. The downside is we have a lot of this defined, right?
Correct.
And so how do we actually understand what we don't know about franchising before we take that plunge? I always say I didn't know what I didn't know when I started
right.
my business. Are there franchising training, like your CFE? Is there something like that they need to consider? Are there classes? What is it we can look for before
we take
the plunge?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, we're trying to work on is how do we help provide that education. Clearly, the franchise disclosure document provides much of this information. There's books out there that others have written on this subject. I mean, part of what I do as a franchise attorney, or perhaps franchise consultants, if a third-party consultant's being use to help evaluate the different franchise opportunities are doing is helping you envision what that life as a franchisee is going to be, the good, the bad, and the ugly, so that you know what you're getting into. But that's something that ought to be out there, that, you know, there's some folks that are looking into, you know, whether, you know, the International Franchise Association or others ought to have, you know, a video on this or that, you know, but there may be some videos out there.
Well, and you said there's an International Franchising Association. Mm-hmm. So any franchisee or potential franchisee can join that in advance, or do you already have to be in a franchise to?
Right. It's limited right now. The membership is limited to franchisors who have an FDD and have done what they're supposed to do. Franchisees who are members of a system that's also a member of the IFA, and then the suppliers industry.
So how much does it vary state to state in franchising agreements and how the states deal with those? Is it pretty consistent?
That's a good question. So we talked about a while ago that the Federal Trade Commission regulates the sale of franchises, and they establish a floor that applies nationwide. But each state can do either choose not to have its own laws and just rely on the FTC rule, or several states, 15 to be precise, have adopted their own franchise registration rules and regulations, where they're actually having the disclosure document sent into them. They're reviewing it. It may provide comments back or just go ahead and approve it as written. And then several of the southern states follow North Carolina's lead and have a Business Opportunity Act, which is a separate, broader law that many franchise systems have an exemption from, but is designed to capture the whole array of both franchises as well as business opportunities, work at home opportunities, right, and those kind of things.
And so if I'm trying to compare apples to apples, and I want to talk to a franchisee in another state as I'm doing things, should I be aware of which states have different rules, or does it come into play in the operational part, or is it just the regulatory and the buy and sell?
Most franchisors are going to have their FDD and franchise agreement uniform with state-specific addendums in the back of the FDD to the extent they're required to make changes to their agreement to comply with those local laws. So, for example, you know, California doesn't allow for out-of-state litigation, so you would have to amend the agreement to say that no matter what the dispute resolution provision says in California, it will be litigated in California.
Interesting. So we're going to take a break to thank our underwriters and give you some information on our local nonprofits. And we will be back after the break with more with Richie Taylor on franchising. Well, we're back and you're listening to Focus on Business. Our topic today is franchising, and our guest is Richie Taylor of Manning Fulton's Corporate and Franchise Law Practice. Richie, let's just walk through the process. I've decided I want to buy a franchise. I've identified it. Where do I start? What are all the steps from starting it, acquiring it, to exiting out?
Sure. So you've identified a franchise opportunity. You'll first make application with the franchisor. Many of them have websites that are very helpful and provide information on the industry. So let's just say you're looking at a pizza franchise. They may have a whole section on their website explaining about the industry and so forth, so you can learn about why this is an opportunity that you want to get into. And there may be franchises that you would not think about. You know, for example, haircutting. Why would I want to buy a haircutting franchise? Well, because I don't know how to cut hair. But that's not necessarily why I'm buying it. I'm buying it because it's a recession-proof business and people have to come back every month and get their haircut. And there's other things that are a business case associated with that particular franchise opportunity. So, we're going to make application. We're going to provide information about us and whether we're a suitable prospect. And obviously, finances are going to be a part of that because the franchisor is going to let you know early on what it's going to cost you, not only in payments to them, but as far as other startup costs, so that you can know if this is the right fit for you based on how much you've got to invest. They probably will have a series of phone calls back and forth, or video chats, and then go out to meet with them for Discovery Day so that you can meet the management team and you can and they can meet you and talk more about the opportunity. And at some point along the way, you're going to receive a copy of the franchise disclosure document, which you'll want to review and make sure that you've understand. And then there's a cooling off period. They have to you have to have that for at least 14 days before you buy the franchise. That's what the law requires.
Now, one quick question: when we're talking about, you're talking about our investment. Can we get, borrow money to buy a franchise?
Yes, if the Small Business Administration has a very active franchise lending program that would help you be able to finance in part the franchise fee. Some franchisors may finance some of the initial franchisee. Most do not, as well as the cost of getting open. So, I mean, your sources of financing are going to be – you're going to have some equity. There's no way around that, right? Because any lender is going to want to know that you've got some equity.
Got some skin in the game.
That's right. That's right. But when you're thinking about the franchise, that's part of the things you want to think about is what kind of – you know, tenant improvement money could I get? Am I going to be able to get a small business loan?
What's my working capital?
Exactly. How long is it going to take me to break even? What am I projecting to break even? And that the franchisor may or may not be able to tell you all of that on the projections because they will decide how much of that they want to put into their franchise disclosure document when it comes to financial performance representations or earnings claims. And if they don't put that in there and it doesn't meet the requirements of item 19 is the part of the FDD we're talking about, then they can't give that to you at any other point in the sales process beforehand. So they've got to make sure that they're meeting that objective standards that are required by item 19 to avoid any kind of misrepresentations. But that doesn't mean that you couldn't talk with other franchisees as you're building out your spreadsheet to think about it. And that's what you want to do. I mean, whether it's with by yourself or with your accountant or other business advisor, you know, consultant, to be able to build out a model of what you think is going to do so that you can then make an informed business decision.
In that 14-day period, we're getting this information. We want to be doing our homework, making our spreadsheets, talking tax issues, talking with our bankers, making sure we have all our ducks in the row before we make the decision to sign the agreement.
That's right. And, of course, you can go longer than that, but it – but the minimum that they're required to give you is that 14-day cooling off period.
So we've made the decision, we're signing the agreement as is, and then what's our next step?
Well, the next step is that you're probably going to – the franchisor is going to meet with you so that you can start selecting a site, planning out what your business plan is going to look like, because now that you've bought the franchise, there's no, they're not trying to seduce you into buying it, which is
all the cards go on the table.
Right, which is what the purpose of the pre-disclosure restrictions are. And then they're going to provide you with their plans. If it's a prototype plan building that's got to be built out, if it's, there's real estate involved, and
so everything from whether it's a freestanding facility, the size of it, all of those kind of things are getting determined at this point.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So the – and that's all going to vary based on each system, right? Each – some systems are different. I mean, McDonald's on the extreme is going to have every bit of this measured out. Other franchise systems may not be as restrictive. It really comes down to what each system has found works for them.
So we're in this, and again, let's go to a McDonald's. If you're in a city, there tend to be less of a small, you know, a footprint. You might be out in farmland, and you see one setting out by itself by the interstate and the only thing around for miles. How do we work with the franchisor to determine ideal location, size of the restaurant, all the amenities that need to come in to support it? Do they help us determine, okay, if we're out exit 300 on the interstate and there's nothing else around and you know you'll be able to pull in a lot of traffic because there's nothing else around, do they help us decide the footprint of the business?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they're over time, they're going to know what model works for them in that kind of market, right? And so that's part of what you're paying for is to have that information provided to you. And so you're going to have access to that information. Obviously, at the end of the day, it's going to be a collaborative decision because, you know, if they want you to build a 15,000 square foot and you want to build a 5,000 square foot, I mean, y'all are going to have to meet in the middle there.
Right. And so when we're making that decision, doesn't that change the amount of investment we need to make as to what size the building is and all of those kind of
right.
things?
Right. And so that's why in item 7 of the FDD, they should have a range of investment so that for all – and should tell you, I mean, that building is, you know, a 5,000-square-foot building, so that you know – You know on the front end how much you're planning to spend, so that way there's not a surprise.
Okay. And if for some reason you find out it really needs to be a 15,000 square foot building, then amend that agreement, or what happens? Or is it there's a 5,000, a 10,000, a 15,000?
Well, that would be a problem from as far as the disclosure is concerned, right? Because
right.
you were given a disclosure that told you one thing, and then those cost structure was in fact lowballed. I mean, that's a problem that everybody's going to have to work through at that point.
So we've got the agreement. We find a location. We are in an agreement what size it's going to be, what it's going to look like. And do we get the contractor? Do they help us get a contractor? How does that next step work?
It'll depend on the franchise system there as well. I mean, some may have an approved contractor. They may have, you know, for example, use Chick-fil-A as an example. I mean, when they go in and they build the thing out soup to nuts. And so, I mean, you walk in, they hand you the keys to the store, and they've built it all out. The other extreme may be just that they have specs that they require, and then you're working with your architect and you're finding a local contractor, and they don't have a relationship in that market where they've had successful contractors before and that they can even recommend one.
Okay.
So it just varies.
So again, when we're doing that homework and making the decision as to which franchise, if we're not going to be comfortable supervising, picking a builder, all of those kind of things, and supervising that kind of thing, then we might choose a Chick-fil-A that is turnkey. They hand you, do everything for you.
Correct.
Versus, again, that's understanding what our options are out there from soup to nuts, right?
Absolutely.
So we're up, we're running. Now what? We've got the building. We're hiring. We're training.
That's right. So your franchisor is going to have a training program that may involve nowadays. Some of that training may be done over the internet.
Okay.
Either before or after, you would go to the franchisor's headquarters or certified training facility to do training. And then there's going to be most franchise systems are going to have a team that they send in to help you with your grand opening, both from a marketing perspective to have a successful grand opening, as well as from a training perspective, because you've got new employees who have to learn how to cook your food or sell your product, and they need to be trained on how to do it the franchise system's way. And so you would want to pay attention to those sections of the FDD to understand what they're both committing to do and what they're not committing to do,
right.
And if then you have to make a determination before you buy as to whether you think that's adequate. And, of course, talking with franchisees would be helpful in making that determination.
So when we come into the franchisee, the first person that's getting trained is me as the franchisee, the person that's buying this, right? All the ins and outs, what we're going to be required to train on, the type of people we need in place, managers, assistant managers. And then there's a curriculum, basically, for us to then pass on to our employees and set up a training program internally, all of those kind of things.
Correct. Exactly. And so they're either going to – so they may require, depending on the system, I mean, they may require that your head chef or your manager come to training as well. Or they may plan that that's all going to be done on site prior to opening. It varies based on the system and what they've – design their training program to do.
So do franchisors kind of do spot audits? They come in and check on their franchisee to make sure they're complying with recipes or cooking hours, those kind of things?
Yes. I mean, a system should be doing a compliance audit, whether they're sending in field representatives that are uniformed and you know who they are, or they may be secret shopping you with secret shoppers.
The mystery diner.
To know that you're delivering on the experience that they want to see delivered.
That would be an interesting job to have, doing the mystery dining.
Absolutely. And you as a franchisee want them to be doing that, I would think, both for your feedback on your own location. Plus, I mean, you've got a lot of your money invested in this business, and you want to know that the guy or gal down the street is following the system as well, so that your common customers aren't having a bad experience down the street.
Because you've invested this money in the brand and what they provide, so you want to make sure that you're not tarnishing that brand and your employees aren't.
That's right, and that your fellow franchisees aren't doing that as well, right? I mean, you want be in the market because you don't want your brand to have a bad name in the marketplace.
Because it's not only they can go to another franchisee of that brand, they can go across the street and get a chicken sandwich instead of a hamburger, or there's a lot of alternatives.
That's right.
So we're in here, we're growing the business. What happens if we wanted a second franchise in the same area? You know, I know of multiple people in the area that have multiple franchises of the same. And so they have three or four or five, let's say McDonald's. How does that work? Is there an advantage to that? What happens?
Well, you need to, before you buy the franchise, that's one of the questions you want to think about is what is your long-term goal? Now, not that you're bound by that goal, but you want to know how that interplays with your franchisor and their strategy, right? Because some franchisors may want to work with what are called area developers, who are people who are on the front end or committing okay. to saying, I want to open multiple units. And they would prefer to have have one person or two people that own the triangle market, for okay. example, as opposed to having 10 different franchisees. On the other end of the spectrum, again, using Chick-fil-A as an example, they have a strong bias, basically, where you only get one franchise, period.
Right.
And because they believe that that allows – they want that franchisee to be focused on how to maximize the traffic through that restaurant
right.
and not be distracted with trying to operate multiple locations. So – those in but many franchisors offer an option for single units and for area developers. And of course, if you don't have an area development agreement, then the ability to expand would be restricted to whether or not the franchisor agrees to let you expand.
So again, it's understanding what we want, our goals, our objectives, and choosing the franchise. If it's one and they only ever allow you one, I guess your mom could buy you one, right? And
run right.
it, right? So, and how we're getting established, and let's stick with Chick-fil-A. They give you one location and you're maximizing that return on it and stuff. But like, I know a couple of the Chick-fil-A's in our area have just been pretty much rebuilt from ground zero. I've seen that too with Wendy's and McDonald's mm-hmm. going green and things like that. How does that come into play? Is that our decision? Is that the franchisor's decision? Is it a combination of, you know, I'm going to shut you down for 3 months, tear it down to the ground, and rebuild something there for you to have a new building?
Well, it depends on the system. For example, McDonald's has a 20-year agreement with no renewal right. So if you're going to want to renew, then
wow.
you're going to sign a new agreement, and that may involve they're doing – those ones you're seeing are probably 20-year-old restaurants
yeah.
who are being torn down and being rebuilt as part of a renewal process. Now, they can do that because there's such a large franchisor and take that position. But most franchise agreements provide for a renewal, and as part of that renewal, typically they're going to be required that you're going to come up to the current standards for your restaurant. It may have intermittent during the term of the agreement may have other intervals at which you need to do a refresh.
Right.
And hopefully they have thought through that. As a partnership with franchisees, you as a franchisor, a good franchisor needs to make sure they have thought through the value proposition of that renewal, I mean, of that upfit.
Right.
Or any new requirement that you're going to put on these franchisees where they're required to spend money. Have you thought through the value proposition of that? And can you show them, either through test marketing or preferably through your own corporate units,
right.
to be able to show them, hey, if you put in this smoothie machine, your sales are going to go up by this percentage,
right?
That's much better than just going to franchisees and saying, hey, look, we want you to spend $50,000 because our intern came up with the idea of having smoothie machines in all of our restaurants.
Right.
That's a very different value proposition.
Well, and it brings me back to one of my past clients in – what we saw in their business was every time there was a new CEO of the franchise organization, they kind of felt like they had to put their stamp on the appearance and the menu of the restaurant. And so every time you got a new CEO, it was like, come in, spend money, capital improvement, add this, take that out, and those kind of things. That's something we should look in that FDD agreement as to how frequently they can do that and require us to make changes, right?
Correct. I mean, and most agreements are going to provide wide latitude to the franchisor to require you to meet the then current standards and to change those standards based on marketplace reality. And again, you want them to be able to do that as long as they're being reasonable in doing that. And that's what, I mean, we tell our clients is that, look, these agreements are great, but it's also a partnership. It's not the same as if you owned all these locations as corporate locations where you could just wave a wand and make things happen. Yes, you may have the legal right to do that, but ultimately you want your franchisees to be enthusiastic about the brand and right. about what you're doing. And so you've got to present, just as you would with other business partners, the business case for why you're doing what you're doing. And if you do that, then guess what? The results will follow. The bad ideas won't get implemented. And you'll have a better franchise relationship with your franchisees and if you're approaching it from that vantage point.
So we've been successful. We've been doing this. We were 49 when we bought it. Now we're 69 and we're heading towards the golf course. How do we exit?
As a franchisor, there are several options for selling the business. I mean, we've seen a lot of private equity transactions where franchisors are attractive targets from private equity firms because mm-hmm. they sit there and say, okay, we've got a long-term agreement here that involves the payment of royalties, and that is something we can go and bank with the bank to be able to borrow right. the money to be able to buy this company on the, you know, as well as, you know, selling out to other strategic buyers. There's some franchisors who have become multi-brand operators within certain segments of the okay. population. So, for example, Dreyer Group out of Waco, Texas. I mean, they own a lot of different service brands or okay. service masters. So they've become owners of multi-unit brands. Investors Management Corporation here in Raleigh, you know, owns both Golden Corral and, you know, Fleet Feet Sports.
Right.
Two different concepts, but yet the common denominator is franchising.
Right. Okay. And so let's say I'm the franchisee. I have five franchises. I've been an area developer for them. But I really just want to walk away from it. Can I will everything to my kids? Can I put it and say, okay, my kids inherit my business? Or does that have to be approved and things like that too?
Most franchise agreements are going to provide that you're upon death or disability, that as a franchisee, yes, you can pass it on to your heirs, assuming that they're qualified to be able to operate it, and that it'd be a window for them to make the determination if they want to own it or not as well. And if not, then they'd have a window to be able to sell it to somebody else, usually 6 to 9 months, to make that decision, because you want to go ahead and get it in the hands of somebody who's going to operate it if the heirs aren't going to operate it, because you don't want the business to deteriorate in value in the meantime.
Now, can the heirs own it and then have somebody like a COO or something that's in charge of it and they don't have to be hands-on? Is that kind of an arrangement that can happen?
Sure. I mean, exactly. I mean, many okay. systems aren't going to require direct involvement. There may be some systems
you don't have to be
that
owner-operator.
Do require okay. owner-operators that are very strong towards that, and that they want to know that the person's actively involved in the business. They feel that that's the best way for their system to grow.
So we've got a few minutes left. So if you had to give three recommendations of what to look for up front in a franchise, the most important things, and then three things to think about as you're growing the franchises and what to be focused on.
Okay, so three things as a franchisee on the front end, it would be the viability of the uniqueness of the business model, the strength of the brand, and the quality of the management team, I think are the three things that I would look at on the front end. As far as ongoing growth, is being collaborative with the franchisor, but following the system, and being committed to building a business that is that's going to be there when you're not there, right? I mean, that's the definition
right, that
of
you
a
don't
business.
Have to be there 24/7.
Exactly.
You have responsible people that can handle it day to day. You have good training, good recruiting, all those kind of things.
Exactly. I mean, to me, that's the definition of equity in a business, is that it's making you money when you're not there.
Right.
if you're having to be there in order for it to make you money, it's not a business, it's a job at that point.
Right. So three things I want to ask you about that are kind of trouble spots I see in a lot of the businesses. The HR employment law type things of Obamacare, benefits, full-time, part-time, those kind of personnel issues. They're still there for franchisees, or perhaps even more so for them in the public perception, the employee's perception of what they're offering. What are some of the steps that we can take to mitigate making mistakes in that aspect of who we hire and how we train and how we present our franchise?
Okay, well, specifically with regards to Obamacare, you know, it currently applies to those who have more than 50 full-time equivalent employees. 50 full-time employees, rather. And so as you're looking at investment decisions, I mean, you need to think through that and ask the franchisor how they're dealing with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare to understand how that's going to impact, and understand how that's going to impact your growth, because that may limit you on your ability to own multiple units if that adding that incremental unit is going to put you everything you own under Obamacare, right? And your model doesn't permit you to be able to pay the costs associated with Obamacare.
When we're dealing again with people issue and performance issues, which I think is where all businesses struggle, how do the franchisors and the franchisees come together to make sure that those training programs, the quality control, that those kind of things are in there?
Well, hopefully your franchisor has training programs that are in modules to help, you know, make sure that there's consistency. That's what they should be focused on, consistency throughout the brand is from an operations perspective, which ultimately should help you should be able to have the benefit of as you're onboarding employees with your business. Now there's, as we talked about earlier, a franchisor is not going to want to get into health and safety issues that aren't integral to the product itself, and aren't going to want to get into employment law issues that aren't integral to the operation of the business, simply because that's the purview of the
right,
the employer, the franchisee, and second, out of fear of being held vicariously liable, in other words, being held as a co-employer of those
right,
franchisees' employees and being subjected to those laws themselves.
What has been the single biggest mistake that you've seen in franchisees in your experience?
Okay, so I'll answer that for both franchisees and franchisors. So the single biggest mistake for franchisees is having unreasonable expectations of what the franchise relationship is going to do for them. I think, you know, managing those expectations on the front end and then throughout the relationship is the number one thing. The biggest mistake I see with emerging franchisors is not understanding that they're entering into a new business model, right? They already have hopefully a successful business. If they don't have a successful business, then they shouldn't be franchising. But if they have a successful business, but they need to understand that they now are developing a different business that's involving the licensing of their intellectual property and know-how to these franchisees, and that they need to make sure that they're adequately committed both in capital, time, and talent, and blood and sweat and tears to that business as they are to the original business. And that original business may be subsidizing the franchise operations for some time, and so they need to know how they're going to fund that.
Well, that sounds like an entirely different show about, do you want to be the franchisor and start your business or a second business by franchising your success?
Right.
So I want to thank you for being on here. Let's give them your website again. It's manningfulton.com. You're in Raleigh. You want to give them your phone number just in case, or your email?
Sure. It's taylor@manningfulton.com, and phone number is 919-787-8880.
All right. Thank you, and we'll be back next week with another Focus on Business interview.